Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now, here's the show.
We're not really concerned about what is actually expressed on the platform. This is not content discriminatory in any way.
One of the architects of the TikTok bill says they don't want to take away your favorite app, or maybe it's your kid's favorite app, but that is one possible outcome here. It's Thursday, March 14th. Happy Pi Day. And this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, armed conflicts are happening all over the world. And one group worries the upcoming elections here could bring conflict the United States. Also, Cole Brower just sailed solo nonstop around the world. She's the first American woman to do it.
I got second place, and so even the first place competitor, when he handed me my trophy, was even crying. I don't know if maybe it just hasn't hit me yet.
That's coming up in about 15 minutes. But first, more on that bill in Congress that would force TikTok to break up with its Chinese parent company or be banned in the U.S. The House passed the bill yesterday, and it now goes to the Senate. President Biden has said he will sign it if it reaches his desk. Supporters say TikTok poses a threat to national security. Well, TikTok and its users say trying to shut down the app violates free speech. Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy is an Illinois Democrat who helped write the bill. Here's his conversation with Scott Tong.
You're also on the Intelligence Committee, so privy to some information other members are not. Is there smoking gun evidence about what TikTok has actually done with American user information or actually done to push misinformation?
Yes. Probably the best way to explain it is TikTok's own representations to Congress and how those have been false. You know, TikTok says that, for instance, American user data is only stored in America and in Singapore. But unfortunately, that is not true. Some of that data has been stored on PRC servers, including sensitive financial information. Mm. A second representation has been that no China-based ByteDance employees have access to American user data. That has also been proven false. And then finally, they've said that this data has never been used against American citizens. Unfortunately, that has also been false because in the most publicized case, they actually used the geolocation data of certain journalists to surveil them when they had revealed problems with the supposed firewall that TikTok had put around American user data. And so in light of this, as well as the fact that ByteDance has extremely close ties to the CCP, indeed, it's editor-in-chief is actually the secretary of the Chinese Communist Party cell embedded at the various highest echelons of the company to control the direction of the company. This relationship is problematic.
Yeah. Now, some would say that this margin suggests this is another episode of Washington, D.C. Beltway groupthink, that this is a new red scare. You know, some of the defenders of TikTok in Congress raise that. Do you have concerns about that?
No, I know that the CCP put out a press release basically saying the same thing. I think that what was one of the most influential things that happened last week that convinced so many people in Congress to vote in favor of this bill was TikTok's own actions. On the morning of the vote in the House Energy and Commerce Committee, TikTok sent out a push notification and a pop-up to millions of users using geolocation targeting of minor children to compel them to call their member of Congress in order to continue accessing content on their TikTok. Well, these offices were flooded with phone calls from children as young as 9 years old. And the kids called in and said things like, "What is Congress? What is a congressman? Please give me my TikTok back." This influence campaign, so to speak, was precisely what infuriated people and got them to basically recognize that this legislation is needed to address, you know, a potential future influence campaign that could come at a much more fraught moment.
Now, as far as the users of TikTok, you know, in the U.S. is something like 170 million people in this country. So about half of the people, who live in the United States use this app. Some of them certainly for what the users consider important uses. As far as hearing from your constituents, did you hear some of their arguments for why it's important to them? Is their feedback important to you?
Absolutely. And I think that the most important thing that people need to understand is this bill is not a ban. It's a requirement to divest. And secondly, it's really not about TikTok. It's about ByteDance. Our expectation is that the platform would continue to operate as it is right now, but that it wouldn't be under the control of the CCP. And this is not without precedent. The best example is Grindr, a very popular LGBTQ app that was owned by a Chinese company. Once the U.S. government found out that the CCP had access to the very sensitive personal data of LGBTQ members of the military and government officials, they forced the Chinese company to divest this particular social media app. Well, it was done very quickly because Grindr was a very popular and valuable social media app, and it was done without disruption to the users. And that's what we would expect with TikTok as well.
Yeah. There is, to some, though, a constitutional question here. Now, you're a lawyer. I don't even play one on the radio. But in the state of Montana, as you know, a federal judge struck down the state of Montana's TikTok ban, saying users are, quote, deprived of communicating by their preferred means of speech. Is there, at the very least, a question of freedom of speech here?
Yes, and that's why this particular bill was structured in the way it was. It's not a ban, it's a requirement to divest. And I think that this particular bill strikes the right balance. I feel that it will pass constitutional muster. And again, we are concerned more about the relationship between the platform and the CCP and the control of the CCP over the platform. We're not really concerned about what is actually expressed on the platform. This is not content discriminatory in any way.
All right, we've been talking to Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Illinois, one of the key sponsors of the TikTok legislation. Congressman, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Scott.
Coming up next, there are a lot of conflicts around the world. If it seems like the headlines have been heavier than usual as of late, you're not alone. After the break, Deepa Fernandez speaks with someone whose job it is to track armed conflict around the world. And one of the places she's keeping her eye on is the United States. More after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank.
non-essential staff from the United Nations are evacuating from Haiti because of the volatile security situation there. In Europe, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the alliance needs to do more to help Ukraine fight the Russian invasion as soldiers there are running out of ammunition. And displaced families in Gaza are breaking their Ramadan fasts with canned goods, if they can get them, as millions rely on aid to survive. If it seems like there's a lot of conflict in the world right now, you're right. But today we want to take a step back to give some more context with Cleena Rali. She's president of ACLED, or the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, which tracks violence and political unrest around the world. Cleena, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
There's so much conflict in the world right now. It can be really hard to process. And I'm wondering if it's just me, or do the world's armed conflicts seem at a crisis point right now? I mean, taken altogether, are they worse than they've been in a long time?
It's certainly terrible at the moment. We've recorded 12% more conflict last year than we had in 2022, and almost 40% more than at the low point of the pandemic. So yes, there is definitely more conflict, and it's actually changed quite a bit in the forms that it's taken.
Well, there's a silver lining of the pandemic, but you know, I'm wondering, some armed conflicts, they're domestic, say like in Haiti, but there are also global wars like in Ukraine, in Gaza. Should we differentiate when looking at armed conflicts as to who is perpetrating the violence on who?
Oh, certainly. And while, of course, the conflicts that happen in places like Ukraine have massive global significance, the conflicts that happen in places like Haiti are far more common. And so the actual impact on what people feel is their security, or rather their insecurity, is in many ways just as profound. So more conflicts like Haiti are actually, I would say, in the longer term, a worse prognosis than intermittent conflicts like Ukraine.
Okay, and we want to get to some of those, but I just have to ask you, because it can be so difficult to hear about all the violence and the death and the destruction around the world constantly. How should anyone listening now think about such large-scale conflicts when it's just hard enough to focus on one crisis at a time?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it's very important to know about these conflicts, although many of the previous almost solutions or attempts to mitigate them have failed. But, you know, forewarned is forearmed in many ways. And so I would encourage people to not get exhausted by it, but to understand how these things come about. And especially, of course, to see the warning signs within our own countries, where we're also seeing more conflict.
Okay, I'm going to take that on board and try not to be exhausted by it right now. Your group's Global Conflict Watch List for 2024 is a list of places where you expect significant change in terms of violence. Can you tell us which countries made the list?
Oh, certainly. Well, I'll give you some examples. Haiti is certainly on the list, places like Sudan, and of course the Sahel. Even though these places are already violent, we expect them to change because in many cases, and especially now, we don't see long-running wars like we do in Somalia, which is very consistently violent. We actually see a lot of shifts in places like my aforementioned Sahel, Haiti, and Sudan. But also, of course, countries like Yemen, where the conflict changes form, shape, and really direction as new powers or new interests become involved.
You know, and I want to ask you about Myanmar, because I think, you know, one of the things that we as a news team do almost daily is talk about what we should cover and where the conflicts are. And somewhere like Myanmar, it's really fallen out of the headlines. How important is it that we continue to follow these lesser known conflicts?
Oh, it's very important, I think, if only because Myanmar is in many ways the most violent place in the world at the moment. You know, we break down conflicts in different ways. It's not just the events and fatalities, but it's also what proportion of the country has been exposed to violence. But in Myanmar, it's quite interesting in how exactly it's violent. It's violent because of how many armed groups operate there. And while we have seen a drastic rise in the unique number of armed groups that we find within countries, in Myanmar, this number is in the hundreds. So you find lots of local militias.
And I want to ask you, Cleena, before we do run out of time about the United States. I have to say I was quite shocked that it made your conflict watch list this year. We, of course, have an election coming up, and I think we externalize this idea of armed conflict to other countries. What are you expecting in terms of conflict here this year?
Yeah, that's a great question. In fact, just today we launched the U.S. Crisis Monitor again, which we had ongoing for the past election. What I'll say is that we do not expect the level of militia activity that we saw in 2020. But what we are seeing is that, especially in swing states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Georgia and Arizona, there are constellations of demonstrations, often, of course, against the current administration, which should give people some pause, not necessarily because they'll turn violent, but because they indicate issues that are creating fragmentation amongst different voting bases. So we would expect a lot of protest. In fact, the U.S. is incredibly prone to protest in the last few years, but much less militia activity than before.
Kleena Rali is president of ACLED, a group that keeps an index of conflicts around the world. Kleena, thank you so much.
Thanks, it was a pleasure.
Coming up, what's it like to spend 4 months at sea in a 40-foot sailboat by yourself? Find out after the break when Scott speaks with the first American woman to sail solo around the world.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank.
Fewer than 200 people have ever sailed solo nonstop around the world. And only one American woman has. Her name is Cole Brower, and she's 29. She completed the 30,000-mile journey last week when she stepped off of her 40-foot sailboat and onto dry land in Spain after 130 days at sea. She was the only woman competing in the race called the Global Solo Challenge, and she joins us now from Spain. Cole Brower, congratulations and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I got to ask you, you've probably heard this question a lot. What is it like to walk on land after, what, 130 days at sea?
So everyone really thought that I was going to like trip or stumble, and people were really concerned about me. My dad even kind of picked me off the boat and carried me for a second. But I think because I had been on the boat for so long and I was exercising on the boat, I was doing things, I wasn't just like sitting down below, and the boat is constantly moving quite quickly, that I never got the vertigo type of feeling that you normally would get.
Well, that's good. You mentioned your dad. You interacted with the world through social media along the way, and we're going to ask about that. But surely you miss the actual people along the way. What was it like to finally see your dad? Did you laugh? Did you cry?
I think I was the only person not crying on the dock. The entire crowd, my parents, my team, even I got second place. And so even the first place competitor, when he handed me my trophy, was even crying. I think I was the only one not crying. And I don't know if maybe it just hasn't hit me yet.
Yeah. Well, as the parent of a couple 20-somethings, can I suggest accept the hugs, accept the crying, accept the appreciation of your parents that you're back on land. My goodness. How did your boat hold up?
My boat held up pretty well, actually. I mean, I was kind of like a little disappointed in how she held up. But when I look at the other competitors and, you know, what it actually takes to go around the world, like, she did great. And I think maybe I'm just a perfectionist in that kind of way. I don't want things to break. I felt like we were going through things too quickly. My team and I, the last couple of days, have been dedicated to looking at what is broken and taking the whole boat apart.
What did break?
And just, oh God, do you want the list?
Or, I mean, most pieces? I don't know.
I think the majority was actually like electronic, electrical. I mean, salt water is just horrible for electronics. And your electronics are waterproof with fresh water, not salt water. And so the salt is just really good at corroding and killing everything.
Yeah. Tell us about the route and what the hardest location, hardest spot was for you.
So you leave A Coruña, Spain, and you travel south, and then you kind of navigate through the Canary Islands, Cape Verde, which is off of Africa, and then you go across the equator. You head down. There's a couple islands off of Brazil. You go through those, and then you take a left turn to go and start your Cape journey. So to be honest, that whole area inside the Southern Ocean, you have the South Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, and the Pacific Ocean. And each individual one is so different because of the currents, because of the wind, the waves, and how close each of these oceans is to the land. And so each have their own struggles. And I think no sailor out there will disagree that the Southern Oceans are by far the most challenging, because there is no way to train in the Atlantic or the Pacific. How rough it actually is.
Oh, wow. You must have learned a lot about the weather patterns, wind patterns, my goodness, because as you say, you can't practice for some of those places.
Yep, 100%. I had a very good team behind me. So my weather router, Chelsea, she had sent out a 10-year historical analysis to me about 3 weeks before the start of the race. And so I read her entire booklet about, you know, the Southern Ocean. She sends me where she thinks that the breeze is going to be coming from. And then I have to decide on what sails to use and how big the sails that I'm going to use and where I'm going to go. We talked every single day. They were like, okay, we trust that your eyes are seeing this firsthand. And you're going to make the right decisions for how big the seas are and how windy it is.
And maybe this is where the electronics come in. How did you stay on course?
So I, of course, have like an autopilot system. And so the autopilot's driving at all times, because the autopilot can drive perfectly 100% of the time, where I can drive perfectly for maybe 10 minutes. On the middle of the ocean, autopilots are 100% necessary, and almost every boat has them. It's just not really possible to drive all night long, and there's no places to like just pull over and park. A lot of the technology is programmable, so you have like a PC and you're constantly programming it for the specific conditions. And I'm not a video game geek. Like, I struggle with that. But everything's a manual. If you can read a manual, you can sail.
You're not a video game geek. You are an Instagram person. And I read that you began with the goal, yeah, maybe 10,000 people following you around the world. I think you're at about, what, 500,000 followers now on Instagram. You were posting a lot during this trip. And we have a little sound we're going to play of one of your Instagram videos from February. Here it is.
I'm totally exhausted. I had a really long night last night. I had a squall hit me just before sunset last night that had about 30 to 33 knots of breeze, and it just felt like it was just forever. Breeze totally turned me around. I ended up going upwind. I did like 16 sail changes.
Oh my goodness. So I understand some of your sponsors were not necessarily happy about you kind of providing a lot of social media updates. How did that conversation go? Because clearly it's something you wanted to do.
So in the beginning, I mean, I had it in my mind that if you wanted to make this important, people had to see it. You know, there's one thing to go around the world, and there's another to actually show the world what you're doing and the sport that is so obscure and, you know, people don't really know about it. So exposing myself onto social media didn't seem like that crazy to me. And to an older generation, it did.
Doesn't that kind of make the point that you are trying to make, that you are trying to be yourself of your generation, the first woman to do this at the age of 29, and you're trying to show this is somebody who can be at the top of this sport, which I gather for a long, long time has been a pretty bro sport.
100%. Like, I just wanted to show it really isn't being like a woman or a man. It's about energies. And so I wanted to show that I could, you know, present feminine energy and feel confident, and that to make other people feel like it's not a bad thing to be feminine, where a lot of men in this industry, they have to give off this almost, you know, too cool for school, strong energy. Mm-hmm. And people that watch that are bored. You know, they've seen it, they're over it. So I think I'm really confident that we're going to start to see in our sports that are super male dominated a little bit of more feminine energy, not just from, you know, women, but also on the men's side.
Mm-hmm. By doing this, Cole, are you hoping to inspire young people to try things, to sail, to do something adventurous? Is that part of why you're doing this?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I have a protege. I started working with her when she was 15, and I think she's now 17, going to be 18 now. And she flew all the way from Connecticut to Spain just to see my finish. Mm-hmm. And I look at her and, you know, her friends and anyone else that I've spoken to about this, is that I am the forefront of this campaign and what's going on, but it's the people behind me that have been lifting me up the entire time. So, you know, my advice to anyone is keep those friends that really respect you and understand your dreams and want to be a part of it. You know, find the people that are willing to participate in your dreams, and don't laugh at you or think that you're crazy, you know, because when you actually get the opportunity, you want to have, you know, some people in your corner.
Yeah. Amen. Cole Brower is the first American woman to sail solo and nonstop around the world. What a great ending. Cole, thank you so much, and congratulations to you and your team.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Ashley Locke, Sam Rapelson, and Julia Corcoran. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Micaela Rodriguez, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto, Michaela Varela, and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. If you're looking for some Pi Day pie recipes, well, we've got some pie recipes from Kathy Gunst in our archives. Just head to hereandnow.org and find that and a lot more. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the NPR Wine Club. Get the world of wine delivered to your door. When you join the NPR Wine Club, you'll receive the stories behind every bottle and favorite NPR shows and personalities arriving in liquid form, like Weekend Edition Cabernet and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Zinfandel. The NPR Wine Club is a delicious way to support NPR's programming. If you're 21 or older, uncork a special offer at nprwineclub.org/podcast.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Leesa.com to learn more. That's LEESA.com.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.